Can we minimize the noise, please, at the background? Thank you. This is a continuation of the meeting that we had on in the morning, receiving the receiving the annual report from the department and its entities. So in the morning we have engaged with the department. Now we are going to allow the entities to present as been put on the screen, and we'll allow them to present, all of them. Members must just note, and then we'll later engage with the presentation. Can we welcome CISOs? And I must indicate that we'll have a five minutes remarks by the chair, and then 25 minutes presentation. The same thing will happen to other entities. We have CISOs, we have Estate Agency Affairs Board, we have National Home Builders Registration Council. So, as been flagged on the screen, can we then welcome their chairs through you, DM Chukwete? Yes, Chair. Yes, DM.
I'm sorry, I was like, what did you say, Chair?
I was saying that we are welcoming the chair of the board and the CEOs through yourselves. Because of the time, we'll allow the chair of the board to make remarks for 5 minutes, and then 25 minutes we'll give it to the board just to raise their achievement and the challenges. Yes, through yourself.
Fine. Thank you.
Okay. Can we then welcome CISO?
Honorable Chairperson, thank you. May I acknowledge the DM and the honorable members, the representation from the DHS, as well as the colleagues in the other entities. My name is Mthobi Chamzashe. I'm the chairperson of CISOs, and I want to just deal with the achievements and challenges in CISOs briefly in the introduction. Our biggest challenge is related to ensuring that all schemes are registered wherever they are. As a result, we have been getting a finding around the completeness of revenue, because if you don't register all of them, you will not be able to collect from them, register them, and so on. So we are here today to say, yeah, we have taken some steps with regard to dealing with the matter of the completeness of revenue, one of which is the procurement of a business automation system, which includes a records management system. And the other one is dealing with the other entities that are also having community schemes registered with them. So essentially, today is to report briefly on the fact that the database of all community schemes is what we've been working on. And to that end, we have acquired the data from the Office of the Deeds, the CIPC, to be able to augment the registrations that we have, because more registrations means more collections. To date, we have been able to register 28,538 schemes, which is a 6% increase over the previous year. And 64% of those are paying, which is an increase of 12% over last year. In terms of rent, it's an increase of 2%. We've been able to collect. And in terms of training, we have held 23 training sessions involving more than 1,000 stakeholders. An important an improvement in the Auditor General's finding from the adverse finding that we have had, we are now on qualified, and hopefully, Chair, that we will see us getting unqualified to negative or adverse findings. We have been able to fill out the posts, 27 permanent posts, and we've increased our presence with the inclusion of the office in the Western Cape in George. And lastly, with regard to the VVS, we continue to receive updates from the Hawks, and as such, we are obviously waiting for them. And on the other hand side, we are forging ahead with trying to find the location of the funding that was in the FNB account, which has not been found there. As such, because we have not been getting cooperation that we need, especially from the FNB and from the curator. So that's what our lawyers are working on. That's my introduction from CISO's chair. Thank you. CEO?
Thank you, Chair. I'll be taking through the committee maybe before I start, just to say thank you to the chairperson of the portfolio committee. I would like also to acknowledge the deputy minister, the members of the portfolio committees and their colleagues from our sister entity and the department. My presentation will be focusing on the operational performance of the organization for the year 1920 financial year. In terms of the performance of the organization, what we're going to be looking at in terms of the overall is we did manage within the financial year to reach at least 47% total performance for the organization. I'll not deal with the strategic objectives of the organization, those are known. In a nutshell, we regulate community schemes. We control and take custody of the quality assurance of schemes governance documentation. We provide dispute resolution for all community schemes. And as part of our mandate, we need to be providing education and training to all the occupiers, executive managing members of the community schemes. Those are the body corporate and the directors of the homeowners association. And obviously, in doing all those things, we need to ensure that we are effective and we will remain a sustainable organization. Our performance overall, we're sitting at 47%, but what I can report is that we have managed to address all the challenges that we've experienced in the previous financial year. So in the coming financial year, there will be some improvements in terms of the performance. The system that the chair has been talking about, we've almost finalized the process in terms of the appointment of the service provider to provide us with the automation. The automation will assist us in ensuring that we are able to account for all the levies that we have collected. It also provides for the case management system. This will allow the community schemes to be able to lodge disputes online and to track their disputes online. That then introduces some efficiencies in terms of the provision of the services. One of the biggest challenges that we have in CISOs, more particularly that has an impact on the registration and payment of levies, is the fact that the Citizens Act doesn't provide us with more enforcement muscle to enforce the registration and payment. We are amending the Act to ensure that it is more aligned, it gives us more power. We have worked on the vacancy rate and most of the positions have been filled. In terms of the performance under the administration, we have met the target in terms of ensuring that we have a point of presence, which is additional to the point of presence that we currently have. As you know, CISOS is operating in Gauteng, Western Cape, and KZN. So we have a satellite office in George. Already in the previous year, we had an office in PE and Bloemfontein. In the next financial year, we are looking at opening an office in East London and Mpumalanga, Free State. The production in terms of the uptown servers, we are fine. The network health, we are fine. In terms of the procurement of the system, I've already detailed that in terms of the fact that we are on already on an advanced stage in terms of the appointment of the service provider. The collection of the levy, which is one of the biggest mandates that we have as CISOS, because with the collection we are able to be sustainable, then we'll no longer be dependent on the government grant. We have managed to collect 217, we're just short with some few millions in terms of us meeting the target. The shortfall is 2.9 million. So in the current financial year with the COVID, we had anticipated that we might have challenges. However, what we have seen is that we're not impacted by that. We are currently meeting our target in terms of the collection of levies. So in the past 2 quarters, we managed to meet the target for both Q1 and Q2 for the collection of levies. So we are hoping in the by end of the current financial year, we will be meeting our target in terms of collection. The revenue management strategy was approved by the board. We are implementing it. In fact, we are already on the advanced stage in terms of ensuring that the implementation is done properly. We are able now to do a lot of allocation that we couldn't do previously. We are also able to account for most of the levies that are paid into our bank account. And one of the issues that the revenue management strategy brought in is to ensure that at least we're able to issue what we call reconciliation statement to all the communities, most of the community schemes that are paying our levies, which is a positive and which is welcomed by most of the members of the body corporate, because they are saying we need to be able to account and for them to be able to see that whatever payment that they have made to CISOS, we're able to account for that and give them a statement for that. We filled the position as indicated and we are continuing to do so in the current financial year. The registration of community scheme, even though it is still a challenge in terms of we are not getting the numbers that we anticipated, it is a slight increase from the previous financial year. In the current financial year, what we're doing, we are implementing the registration strategy and the compliance and enforcement strategy that has been approved by the board. The two strategies have provided us with some remedial action towards ensuring that there is increased registration by community scheme. So with the information that we received from the DIS office and the CIPC, currently we have also received the information from the Surveyor General. That information has assisted us in terms of now we know the universe of the entire community schemes in South Africa. We will be issuing the non-compliance notices to all those schemes that have not registered. And we are hoping that together with the go-to-market campaign that we'll be implementing, which will ensure that CISOS is known, will attract the registration submission to CISOS. With the registration, there will be increase in terms of payment of levies and service provision. I'll not go into details in terms of the breakdown for the schemes that have been registered. The governance documentation, this is one role that CISOS is playing currently. You will know historically that body corporate or regional titles used to submit their governance documentation to DIS office. The challenge was that the DIS office used to receive those documents and file them. So there was no one who used to look at those roles and constitution to ensure that they are compliant, they are unfair, and that they are applied fairly. So CISOS' role is to ensure that we eradicate any roles that are seen as undesirable or any role that is seen to be unfair So we do check those rules against the Constitution of the Republic of South Africa, the provisions of the applicable legislation. We also take into account the relevant court cases to ensure that whatever we approve is proper and can be applied and can stand the challenges, whether it be by court or any other forum. And after we have quality assured, we are able to then to issue a certificate to a community scheme to inform them that their rules are compliant. What we have done is we have embarked on education and training to ensure that the body corporates, the sectional titles, understand the process that they need to follow in ensuring that their rules are approved. There is an improvement in the current financial year as there is compliance from community scheme in ensuring that they submit the amended rules on time. The dispute, we are sitting at 70%. This is 4,891 disputes that we finalized in the financial year. So one of the issues that needs to be noted, more particularly with dispute, is we do not have control in terms of the number of disputes that can be submitted to CISOS. So what we have done is to ensure that at least we are able to deal with whatever influx that comes in through the dispute. We have appointed 24 part-time adjudicators to assist with the finalization of the dispute. With the appointment of part-time adjudicators, it allows us to have a situation where we don't have a ballooned structure where we have lots of employees. So the part-time adjudicators, they come in and assist as and when they are required, because obviously we need to be mindful in terms of the capacity that we have internally. We do have internal part-time internal adjudicators and internal conciliators. However, as and when there is an influx, we bring in the part-time adjudicators to assist in dealing and finalizing the disputes. What I can mention is in terms of the measures that we've implemented in the current financial year due to COVID, which restricted the face-to-face interaction, we have implemented what we call visual conciliation, and all our adjudication are currently done on paper. This is one of the initiatives that has been accepted by the industry. They're happy. It ensures that the disputes are dealt with quickly, and it removes emotions in terms of the adjudicators able to consider the matters without being influenced. Most of our disputes are coming from housing. This is in line with the number of community schemes, professional titles, and homeowners associations that are registered in the Republic. The highest number is GP, followed by both KZN and Eastern Cape. The training and education sessions that we undertook, this is one of the objective or the strategic focus that we are doing very well. We have received a lot of positive reviews in terms of our training that we do to community schemes, body corporates, to homeowners association. We managed to do 23 training sessions in the previous financial year, which is 19 more than what we had targeted. To mitigate the COVID, we are currently doing most of our training visually, and we also have videos that we are going to be distributing through YouTube. This will also allow the stakeholders to access our training without us having to be there in person to train them. So this is continuing. Also, in the current financial year, we are moving forward in terms of ensuring that our curriculum that we'll be using and the material that we'll be using for the training of stakeholders is accredited. This is the move by CISOS to ensure that the entire education and training within this environment is formalized. The core staff, those are the employees internally that we train. So as and when there is change in legislation, there is new case that come in, there's a new adjudication order that comes in, we then ensure that there is training that is done to all core employees who are the adjudicators and conciliators, so that they are up to date in terms of all the issues that are happening in the country. And also, as and when there is some development internationally, for them to be abreast in terms of issues that are happening. We had our website, we launched it. You can go visit our website. It looks good. You can navigate through it much easier compared to what was happening in the previous financial year. We issue our e-newsletter on a quarterly basis. This is the information session that we communicate to the body corporate, the sectional titles, in terms of the achievement of CISOs, any information, the directives that we issue. We issue, we communicate through the e-newsletter to all our stakeholders. And we executed for marketing campaigns. I'll hand over to the CFO to take us through the financials. Thank you.
Thank you, Chief Ombud. Chairperson of the Portfolio Committee, the Deputy Minister, members of the Portfolio Committee, and colleagues from other entities. I'll be taking you through our financial statements for the 19-20 financial year. I'll first start by showing a snapshot, a highlight of our income, which was 264 million, with levies making 84% of that amount at 217 million. Our key highlights was the audit opinion improved, as mentioned earlier, from an adverse opinion to a qualified opinion. Also, we are implementing our revenue management strategy, which was approved by the board. And we are also filling vacancies within the finance unit. In terms of our financial position, our total assets were sitting at 236 million at year end, which is a 25.7% improvement from the prior year. Our liabilities were sitting at 9 million. They went down by 9.52%. And our accumulated surplus at the end of March 2019 was 227 million. Moving on to our financial performance, our total revenue, as indicated earlier, is 264 million. And our total expenditure was at 97 million, which gave us a surplus for the year of 167 million. This is the statement of changes in net assets, which shows how we got to our accumulated surplus of 227 million. And then our cash flow statement, which reflects our cash inflows and outflows for the financial year. In terms of our comparison of the budget and the actual expenditure, we under-collected on revenue by 3 million, the bulk of which came from the levies, where we did not meet our target by 2.9 million. And then our surplus, we over-collected by 141, or we have a surplus of 141 more than we had budgeted for. In terms of our audit outcomes and remedial actions, we did not receive any findings on performance information. The major finding is on revenue, which is the basis of our qualified opinion. And it was mainly on the completeness of revenue, being that we do not have a full database of our community schemes. And with that, as mentioned earlier by the chairperson, we've collected data from the CIPC, from the DIS office, and from the Surveyor General. What we have done now is completed, we are concluding a data cleansing exercise where we have been checking the data that we have on our database, cleansing it to take out any discrepancies. What we are also doing is comparing it to the data that we received from the three entities. And then from there, we'll be following up on schemes that we have identified not to be registered with us. Our second finding on revenue was that we did not measure it on an accrual basis as required in terms of Graph 23. What we're doing there is we are amending our forms, CS1 and CS2 forms, for us to obtain more information from the community schemes, so that we have reliable information to be able to build them. And we are also in the final stages of procuring our BESS system that will help us with the billing of the community schemes when we have all the information that we need. We also had unallocated levies and receivables, which are being addressed now. The other issue was how we accounted for that in the financial statement. We have appointed a technical financial advisor who's going to advise us on how to account for our unallocated levies in such a way that it will reflect fairly on the organization. Also on the supporting evidence on unallocated and allocated levy, it goes back to the amendments that we are making to our forms for us to get information that we can use, and also on the best system where we'll be able to bill our community schemes and be able to provide evidence at the time of the audit. Next finding is on expenditure, the monthly creditors reconciliations. We appointed an expenditure manager towards the end of the financial year, 1920, who has now started to compile the reconciliations on a monthly basis. He started in August, so that is on track. 30-day payments, non-compliance. We have since implemented a central mailbox where all our suppliers will send us invoices, and we are able to track the 30 days from the date that we received the invoice. We've also increased the number of times that we make payments in a month from twice to three times in a month, and we have seen improvements in that. At the end of quarter two, we had an 85% compliance rate. On the property, plant and equipment, there was a residual value assessment that we had not done, which we subsequently did. To address that, we will be developing a checklist that will assist us at the end of the financial year to make sure that we comply with all the standard requirements. In terms of related parties disclosure, it was an immaterial adjustment that we made to the financial statement in the norms, as well as contingent liabilities. It was an immaterial misstatement that we were able to correct. Even for the risk management note, the commitments and the cash flow statement. In terms of future operational outlook, we are in the process of amending the CISOP Act to allow for stronger powers to enforce registration and payment of levies, and increase CISOP's obligation to ensure governance within community schemes, the appointment of investigators or inspectors to conduct inspections, the provision for the process of dealing with the internal appeal against adjudication orders. We are drafting this policy, the CISOP's policy that will support the amendment, and we are also undergoing a social economic impact assessment system phase one. I'll hand back to the Chief Ombud to take us through the governance.
Thank you, Witumelo. In terms of governance, I'll not go into detail. Just to mention that our board is still in place. We just have two vacancies that the minister is attending to. Our executive team, we are fine. We only have the vacancy, which is the CFO, which the minister is also looking at. In terms of the human capital, we are sitting at 113 in terms of the positions within CISOP, which will be increasing in the current financial year. I'll hand over back to the chair for his concluding remarks. Thank you.
Thank you, CEO. Chairperson, the only remaining thing was to highlight what we did this year. We basically tried to address all these challenges by adopting some five big ideas, and those are to fast track the appointment of the senior executives. As mentioned, now these two are waiting for the minister's consideration. Secondly, we are moving premises, because where we are sharing the premises that are quite congested and that were a problem, particularly during the pandemic. We're moving premises from January onward. And then in terms of what the committee has always complained about CISCOS not being very well known, we have now approved a campaign It's called the go-to-market campaign, which will be in radio, TV, and print. And the IT system, which will do away with many of the audit findings, as well as ensure that we at least move from the qualified finding to a better finding. And then the BBS Mutual Bank is what we mentioned earlier. Otherwise, the efforts that we did by just adopting these five key priorities were meant to make sure that we don't come and give excuses here, but we actually show what has actually been done. With that report, Chairperson and Honourable Members, we thank you for the opportunity, and we will be happy to take questions at the appropriate time. Thank you.
Hello, Chairperson.
Why don't we allow the second entity to present while we're still waiting for the chair? Because I think the chair said they are all going to present and then members will take notes and then we come in after that.
Yes, that's what she said, Minister.
Yeah, we agree with you, Deputy Minister. Can the second entity present?
Okay, good afternoon, Deputy Minister, Chairperson, Honourable Members. My name is Yusuf Patel. I'm the Deputy Chairperson of the Estate Agency Affairs Board. And just up front, just to note apology from our Chairperson, Mr. Nkosinathi Biko. He unfortunately was not able to join the session, but I am here to maybe just give you some quick highlights, and then the CEO and the team will take you through the presentation. I think what's important maybe just to note is that for the 2019-2020 financial year, the entity has at the board level has received a qualified audit opinion, and this was mainly due to understated revenue. We collected slightly more on fines and penalties, so it was due to that we received that qualified audit opinion. But in terms of I think there's been significant progress from the previous years, and then on the side of the fund, the entity has received an unqualified and clean audit. So I think, you know, overall on the financials, there's been significant progress. There are a number of issues around that have been highlighted, which the team, the CEO and team will take us through. I think the second area just to highlight for the some of the impact we're reporting is also there is some level of financial impact due to the towards the end of the financial year and with the onset of COVID, but a lot of that is, you know, also comes into the new financial year. But there was some revenue lost, we had to look at also some certain measures to try and mitigate for some of the revenue losses. But again, I think on the financial report, Chair, we will provide more details. Maybe just to indicate on on transformation, there's been significant progress made. We're busy implementing the PDI resolution, which is really, you know, looking at making access into the industry much more easier. So some of the regulatory kind of requirements are being relaxed, and also some of the financial requirements, you know, been reduced through the PDI resolution. So there's important progress there. And then the second element around transformation is related to the incubation program, where there's support being put in place for SMMEs and for principal estate agents, you know, to really assist and develop and ensure that they have processes in place to support the principalization and development. And then the third element of transformation is around the internship program, where we have about 2,000 young people participating currently in that program. I think, Chairperson, those are some of the key things, and in relation to, you know, moving forward also with some of the priorities, we obviously, there's been a lot of consolidation in the overall structure and management at the EAB. There are still a number of posts and some also key posts we needing to conclude and ensure that we're putting in place permanent appointments. So that process is, you know, is on track. And in
Sorry,
terms of...
I don't see the presentation here.
No.
I don't know whether it's me or not.
No, apologies. I'm not talking, Chairperson. I'm not talking to any slides. I was just giving some introductory highlights, and the CEO will take you through the presentation. But it just the last point I was making is around, we've got a risk register in place, and you know, in terms of that, there's also a process in place to ensure that any and all identified risks, that we're tightening processes with regard to that. So, Chairperson, thanks for that. I was just giving you a high level introductory overview. The presentation will be done, and I'll hand over to the CEO. Thanks.
Thank you, CEO.
Thank you, Deputy Chairperson. Good afternoon, Honourable Chairperson. Good afternoon, Honourable Members. Good afternoon, Deputy Minister and all other colleagues. Chairperson, we are pleased to present the annual report for 2019-2020 on behalf of the Estate Agency Affairs Board. The team that is here with me to do the presentation is the Acting Chief Financial Officer, Madame Karen Son, and we're also assisted by Dade France Mansour, who is the Chief Risk Officer, who's also responsible for strategy. Chairperson, you'll note that we have submitted a very lengthy presentation. I think, Chair, it comes from the enthusiasm in relation to the kind of work output that we've been doing, and you will see that there has been a vast improvement in relation to the work output of the EAB. But we will not go through every slide, because we have over 100 slides that have been presented. We will just speak to the highlights and the key areas. I will obviously speak to the audit outcomes briefly, then I will hand it over to the Acting CFO, who will talk to the financials. I'll then come in and deal with registration, transformation, and I'll also speak to the Property Practitioners Act, and then I will ask the CRO to close off by speaking to the operational outcomes. Thank you very much, Chair. If we could move to the next slide, please.
But you must share 30 minutes, all of you.
Yes, we will. We will be done in 30 minutes. We will not take long, Chair. That's why we'll only deal with the highlights. As I've already indicated, Chairperson, we are here to present the annual report for 2019-2020. The Estate Agency Affairs Board has got two core businesses. We've got the business of the board, which is the controlled entity. There is one subsidiary that also reports to the controlled entity, which is the Fidelity Fund. And we're here to present the audited annual financial statements for both entities as of 31st March 2020. Now, with this next slide, please. With regard to the audit outcome for the board, as the deputy chairperson has already indicated, we have unfortunately received a qualified opinion in relation to the board, and this was similar to last financial year where we received a qualified opinion on one specific item. And I think it must be understood that I'm only speaking to the basis for the qualification. We do have a management report that speaks to other issues that the AG has noted for improvement. But in relation to the qualification, we have been qualified on only one item, and as has already been stated, it has been stated by the AG that there has been an understatement in relation to the penalties that we collected, and the understatement is reflected as being in the region of 2.4 million, and that it has as a consequence of that, it has an impact on the audit report and in relation to the reported surplus. And as such, the AG made a decision that they would want to qualify us. We have had a lot long debates and discussions with the AG because we did not feel it was a correct basis for qualification, but obviously the AG has a final say in relation to this matter. So we stand qualified with regard to the board, and again, it is qualification on one matter. Could move to the next slide. With regards to the Fidelity Fund, which is where the majority of the money that runs the EAB and the money of the estate agent sits, we are glad to report that last financial year we had an unqualified audit. We have improved. Within this financial year, we have now received the clean audit, which would mean then that all the systems within the Fidelity Fund are aligned to what the AG would accept and would recognize as acceptable in terms of the standards. So I do believe that there has been a vast improvement with regard to the Fidelity Fund, and we're anticipating in the next financial year that we'll retain the Fidelity Fund as a clean audit, and we expect that the board will move from a qualified audit to an unqualified audit. But without further ado, Chair, I'd like to hand over to the acting CFO so that she can then speak to the details of the financials, and I'll come in back in with regard to registrations and transformation. Thank you, Chair. Karen?
Okay. Thank you very much, CEO. Good afternoon, Deputy Chairperson, honorable members of the Portfolio Committee. I am just going to take you through the presentation. Can you see the next slide? I'm not sure why it's not changing.
Could we move to the next slide, please?
Okay. I'm sorry, my screen has just frozen.
Kwaliswa, are you able to put... Kwaliswa? Hello, Chair.
Are you able to see the presentation?
Yes, you can. Okay, let me.
Yes, okay.
Thank you. I'm just going to talk to the financial performance of the EAB as well as the Fidelity Fund and the group. Firstly, just on our statement of financial position, in terms of the group had a total assets of 807 million. Our current assets are really made up of our investments, our receivables, as well as our cash and cash equivalents. Our non-current assets are made up of our property, plant and equipment. Current liabilities is payables from exchange transactions, as well as provisions. And our non-current liabilities is the post-retirement medical aid benefits. In terms of the board, our current assets are made up of our receivables as well as the loan fund. Non-current assets are property, plant and equipment. Our current liabilities are made up of payables, deferred revenue and provisions. And the 4.9 million of current liabilities is the post-retirement fund. Our current assets increased from 117 million to 120 million, and this is really attributable to increase in receivables from exchange transactions, mainly from FSC renewals, CPD, and exam fees. Our loan fund decreased by 22%, and this was really due to payment by the fund of the outstanding management fees, as well as the loan of 8.2 million, which was to settle the pension fund conversion costs. Our current liabilities increased by 21.2%, from 69 million to 84 million, and this is really mainly due to the increase in deferred revenue, as well as debtors with credit balances. And our non-current liabilities shows a reduction to 4.9 million, and this is due to the settling of the pension fund conversion costs. And this effectively means that currently the board only has obligations in terms of post-retirement medical aid. We no longer have any obligation in terms of the pension fund. Then in our financial performance for the group, we had revenue from exchange transactions, and this is new registrations, renewals, exam fees, interest, revenue from non-exchange transactions, is mainly fines, penalties, as well as interest on our trust account. Expenditure was employee-related costs, board costs, and other operating costs. And the group had a deficit of 14 million, and this is mainly attributable to the deficit that was in the fund, but I'll talk more about that when we get to the fund. With regards to the board, we had revenue from exchange transactions, which is renewals, exam fees, CPD fees, as well as management fees. The non-exchange transactions relate to fines and penalties, for mainly for people that pay late or renew their FSCs late. Then employee-related costs, board costs, and other operating costs. Okay. Our total revenue decreased by 24% from last year to this year, and one of the main factors was that we had to correct invoices that were overstated in 2018-19, and this resulted in a prior year adjustment of 7.2 million. Another factor was a decrease in the fines and penalties. I think we did try and issue renewal invoices on time, and you saw people actually paying their renewals on time. Our total expenditure decreased from 16% from 170 million to 142 million, although our employee-related costs increased by 2.3%. As you can see for the group, we had a deficit for the year of 14.7 million, mainly attributable to the deficit in the fund. As far as the board is concerned, we had a surplus of 1.9 million, which took our total net assets for the year to 153 million. In terms of the cash flow statement for the group, we had a net cash outflow from operating activities. This was mainly due to the loss. Our net cash flows from investing activities, 134 million. This is really, and I'll talk more about this when we get to the fund, but it's really because one of our investments was due to mature in a short space of time. And so in terms of GRAP, we just needed to classify it as cash and cash equivalent. Just in terms of the cash flow for the board, we had a net cash outflow from operating activities, and this was mainly as a result of both an increase in our receivables as well as our payables. Our cash flows from investing activities, the 1.7 million, was due to the purchase of mainly computer equipment. Net cash flows from financing activities, the 11 million was for the repayment by the fund to the board of the loan fund account, and our cash and cash equivalent at the end of the year was 7 million. Okay. I'll then move on to the fund. The other financial assets in the fund is the investments that we have in the fund. The reason for the big decrease is, from the 632 to the 482 was really because of the Investec investment, which we now show as cash and cash equivalent, simply because to meet the GRAP requirements, but subsequent to year end, the funds were reinvested. Okay. Our liabilities were the loans from the EAB to the fund of 39 million. This was a decrease from last year, mainly due to the payment of management fee as well as the settling of the conversion costs. And then our provision increased, and this has mainly as a result of the provision for claims. Okay. I will talk a little bit more about the devaluation of the Liberty investment when I get to the next slide. Okay. So our revenue from exchange transactions is mainly contributions from estate agents, as well as interest from investments and claims recoveries. Revenue from non-exchange transactions is the interest on the trust fund accounts, and our expenditure is mainly the management fee, as well as the fair value adjustment loss. Now, our revenue from exchange transactions decreased mainly due to the 33 million reduction in the Liberty investment, which happened in March 2020. And this devaluation negatively affected our fair value adjustment. This also led to the fund reporting a deficit due to this 33 million devaluation. And now, we do not agree with Liberty Life and the way that they devalued our investment. We therefore took a resolution to investigate the matter further. And the service provider that handles all our investments and their legal team noted there was no basis for Liberty to reduce the value below because there is a guaranteed portion within the policy document. So we are currently challenging this devaluation with Liberty. And as a result of this, you will notice that we have reflected a contingent asset in the notes to the annual financial statements. Okay, and that is really the reason for the deficit of the 15 million for the year, as well as the reason why our net assets have decreased from 584 to 568. And if I go to the cash flow statement, this is also the reason why, in terms of our cash flow, we have a net cash outflow from operating activities of 15 million. The net cash flow from investing activity, this is just the Investec fund that is just classified as cash and cash equivalents in terms of the GRAP standards. Okay. Thank you, CEO. I'll hand back to you.
Thank you very much, Karen. If we could just move to the next slide. Chairperson, I'm going to go through the registration unit of the EAB. The registration unit deals with the issuance of Fidelity Fund certificates, which I'm sure you all know is the tool of trade of all estate agents and is the lifeblood of the business of the EAB. I'll deal with the issuance of Fidelity Fund certificates in three categories. Category to full status agents and third category to interns. The slide number 31 deals with all the categories of Fidelity Fund certificates that have been issued, which are attorney employees, firms, interns, non-principal, non-executive, and principal agents. The total number of Fidelity Fund certificates issued in the 2019-2020 financial year has been 47,356. You will see that there has been a drop from 2019. And we do believe that to a large extent it has been influenced by the lockdown and the COVID situation that befell us in the last month of the financial year. But going on specifically into the specific categories, if we could move to slide number 33. Slide number 33 speaks to the first category, which relates to principals. You will note that in relation to the principals and the Fidelity Fund certificates issued, you will see that the lowest category there is in relation to colored estate agents, followed by Indians and followed by Africans. But you will see that even with the combined three categories, the numbers are much, much lower than
your white estate agents who are sitting at 6,863, which is a clear indication that transformation still needs to take place quite extensively in, within the sector. I will now go specifically to the next slide that speaks to the provincial spread in relation to the principles. You will see that the sector where there's still the high, I mean the province where there's still the highest number of registered estate agents would be Gauteng, followed by the Western Cape, and thirdly by KwaZulu-Natal. But you will see that there's still a dire need in some of the provinces, for instance, such as Limpopo and the Northern Cape, where we need to intensify our work in relation to making sure registration of people takes place. Can we move to the next slide, please? That just gives you a breakdown, a racial breakdown in terms of the different provinces. We could move to the next slide. Now, the next category is the full status agents, which is your estate agents that are qualified, but that are not principals, because principals can run their own businesses, but full status agents, even though able to trade on their own, for their own account, are not in a position to actually run their own businesses. But you will see that, similarly to the situation of principals, you will see that the numbers of non-white estate agents are far much lower than the white estate agents, which again shows that there's still a vast need to actually work on transforming the sector. Because if you compare the African estate agents, you will see that there has been a slight increase from the 2019 to the 2020 financial year. Even when you look at the colored estate agents, you will see that there's been an increase even with the Indian estate agents. But they are a far cry from their white counterparts who are sitting at 10,000, whereas the other racial groupings of estate agents make up even less than 1,500. We could go down to the next slide. The next slide then also speaks to the provincial spread. Again, in terms of a provincial spread, you will see that Gauteng is in the lead, followed by the Western Cape, and thirdly we have KwaZulu-Natal. The third category is the intern estate agents. You will see there, in terms of the intern estate agents, the numbers obviously look a lot higher when it comes to black female estate agents. There has been a drop from the last financial year, and we really think a lot of them did drop out just because of the economic downturn. But I'm sure that you know that before even COVID, the property sector was experiencing an economic downturn, and that then had a direct impact with regards to the number of agencies that could take on interns and obviously the number of interns that could register. And you will see there that there has been a drop in relation to female estate agents. As black female estate agents, there has been a drop with regard to black male estate agents. And even in relation to the colored as females and males, you do note that there's a drop. It's only, and then you'll also see even with the Indians, there is a drop. But even with white estate agents, there is a drop. But still, in comparison, the numbers are still much higher for your white estate agents as opposed to your black estate agents. If we could just also look at the provincial spread with regard to the intern estate agents, if you could go to the next slide. The next slide then obviously speaks to the provincial breakdown, and you will see that in terms of the provincial breakdown, again, Gauteng is in the lead, sitting at 10,000, followed by Western Cape, which is 4,000, and KwaZulu-Natal. But one must note the fact that it would seem that the real estate sector is viewed by a lot of young people as being an area for job creation and employment creation. And as such, you will see that in terms of internships, we do have a huge number of black and is always in relation to the retention of these young people. And you will see that there is a drop from the last financial year. And unfortunately, as the year progresses, we do experience further drops in relation to estate agents and their team and retaining them within the sector. Okay, I'll end there with regard to the aspect of registration. I'm going to ask that we could then go to the next area, which is transformation, which is slide number 69. You will see that the slide that I will not really deal with in great detail is the education unit, the inspections unit, and the legal compliance unit. And the reason I will not really deal with them in great detail is because in terms of the audit, we did get an unqualified audit in relation to our performance information in relation to those units. And as such, if there are questions, we will be willing to take those questions. But I do not believe that there's anything that's of real concern in relation to those units. We have performed, and we performed to an acceptable level in terms of the audit. Now, with regard to transformation, Transformation is a key imperative of the East State Agency Affairs Board, and it's important for our mandate. And I'm sure from the registrations, you can see that it is quite critical that we make sure that we increase the number of Black property practitioners within the sector. We increase the levels of participation among youth, women, and people with disabilities within the property and the real estate sector. But we also, these initiatives of transformation will help mitigate high levels of poverty, inequality, and unemployment. And as such, we want to promote self-employment and improve the delivery within the real estate sector. Could we move to the next slide? Which programs have we then put in place in order to achieve our imperatives for transformation? As the Deputy Chair has already indicated, one of our programs is the One Learner, One Estate Agent program. It is a program that we are improving. This is where we deal with youth employment and bringing young people into the sector. We have brought in a substantial number of young graduates into the sector in terms of this program, and it also helps young people to get a feel of the real estate sector. And if they like the sector, a lot of them then stay within the sector and grow within the sector. The other program is in relation to the principalization or principalization program using incubation and the development of SMMEs. This is the program whereby we are taking in people who want to start companies, and we are funding them and assisting them with both the grant and with a combination of a grant and a loan. And the board has earmarked certain amounts that will be used to help them. But most importantly, we have set aside support mechanisms in terms of assisting them with marketing initiatives, assisting them with building skills around business development, and with giving them skills around financial support and financial sustainability of the entities. We believe that these mechanisms will make sure that not only do people stay in the sector, but those who join the sector see the benefits and the prospects of growth in the sector. But the most critical aspect of the incubation program is that we also assist them with access to markets. And as I already have presented before this committee, we are in discussions with the Department of Public Works and Rural Development and our sister entities such as SHRA and such other entities to make sure that we get access to markets to our estate for our estate agents. The last two important programs from a transformation point of view is the public awareness program, whereby we have indicated before this committee that we are trying to reach other markets other than the usual markets that we've been infiltrating. We are now speaking more to your township markets. We're now speaking to more to your rural markets in order to increase awareness about the Estate Agency Affairs Board and the work that we do. The last program is the PDI resolution program, which I think the Deputy Chair has also spoken to, but I'll briefly indicate that it is the program whereby we are removing or reducing regulatory impediments from a financial impediment point of view for estate agents, so that they can easily stay in the market and are not removed or are pushed into the illegal market because they cannot afford the financial implications of staying registered from a regulatory point of view within the sector. And we believe that all these programs are beginning to bear fruit. The last area I'm going to deal with is the Property Practitioners Act. If we can go to slide number 87. It would be remiss of me, Chair, to speak and to finalize this presentation without speaking to the Property Practitioners Act. We really welcome the Property Practitioners Act. We think it's going to revolutionize the industry. But over and above that, it will also allow the Estate Agency Affairs Board to actually come full circle, because we'll no longer just be regulating estate agents. We will be regulating property practitioners, which will include your bond originators, your bond brokers, your auctioneers, your managing agents, etc. And we believe that with the advent of the Property Practitioners Act, we will then be able to fully regulate the full spectrum of all property practitioners, and we'll also be able to fully implement the transformation agenda, because the Act also provides for a transformation fund that will be established in order to support transformation and its initiatives. Chair, on that point, I'll just ask my colleague then speak to briefly to the successes and the challenges in relation to operations, and then we'll close. Thank you, Chair. Franz?
Thank you, CEO. Through you, Chair, thank you, and good afternoon to all the members of the committee. I'll quickly go through the successes of the organization and finalize with the operations of the performance of the institution. As indicated, and I won't repeat, we have been audited in the Fidelity Fund, although, yes, we have qualified on the fund, but this is extremely a landmark that we have done, considering that there's progress. And then we have basically, when it comes to irregular expenditure and wasteful expenditure, which is the critical question that's often asked in this committee, we do not have irregular expenditure that was incurred in the 2019-20. The one that has been presented is relating to the prior years, and of which we were forced to comply with the PFM regulations and disclose as to what happened in the previous financial period. And overall performance, the AG has audited the compliance programs. Other programs were not audited because of the COVID restrictions in terms of the timelines. But in terms of that, before we can go there, we'll go to the performance when I talk about that. But the overall performance has extremely done well compared to any other year. So the government and the SCM, I'll go to the SCM as well. There's not been any funding in SCM, HR, and then because of all these updated policies that we had to go and polish and authorize them and comply with them. The only thing that is of significance, a problem of which there is a solution that is being dealt with, is with regards to the ERP. You will find that even on our qualification as a result of the revenue, it's all related to the ERP process, whereby nothing has been automated. We have been able to work under extreme hard conditions on a manual basis, and then where ERP intervention is to a certain limit. So going forward, because there's the current ERP process evaluation that is currently happening, we should be able to finalize it at the end of this year, latest January, and then that should be able to eradicate all the problems that we have. Although it comes later in the last quarter of the new financial year, but that's a good control, and that will make us to be able to move forward. And then going forward, even the PMS is in place now, and then everything is looking better compared to last year. I'll go straight to the performance information and relating to the program that has been audited by the AG. As you can see, where we did not achieve the target, I'll start with the self-assessment. We did not, and it is like a slight margin from the annual target of 1,000 self-assessment to 944, where there is about 56 difference. And this is because of COVID-related issues, because all our teams, when they had to do the self-assessment, everything was done physically. And then, unfortunately, in the last quarter of March, when everything was being finalized, the president announced the lockdown, and we had an issue as well in our offices where we have to close the office in the week prior the announcements by the president to stay at home. So the next one, if you can go to the next slide, Karen, please, where we did not achieve. As you can see, we had a target as well of 70% of renewal of Fidelity Fund certificate issues to the current registered and compliant listed agents, whereby we have a variance of 20% compared to the 60% target that we had. You know, so mainly that has been linked to the IT challenges that we had, and of which we are doing something about it, and it has been of a great concern. Next slide, please. I won't concentrate on where we overachieved. The last one or two that we haven't achieved is as a result of the FIC inspection performed. Our team of inspectors, unfortunately, again, during that time where they have to finalize the last FIC inspection, they were forced to come back and fly back to Joburg, because all the flights were going to be grounded soon. And as a result, that affected us. So you can see that all these issues that we have is something that we did not have control over, but everything was in line to ensure that we do comply and achieve our target as much as we can. So as a result of that, the overall achievement of our programs, I'm not going to go through other programs, has been extremely well, given that the situation that we had. And it's as a result of all these issues and controls that are in place. Although our controls are not 100% up to scratch, but the ERP implementation will definitely make a big, significant progress in terms of going forward next year. in ensuring that all the internal controls be mentioned by the AG address. The governance issues, we have the board, we have all the committee members. The only thing highlighted on our audit report is the internal audit, which we did not have for most part of the year, of which that part also has been addressed, and we should be able to have our internal audit company appointed by end of this year. Thank you.
Chairperson, we're open for any questions that the members would like to ask. Thank you.
Thank you. NHPRC.
Thank you. Thank you, Honourable Chair, Honourable Deputy Minister, Honourable Members of the Portfolio Committee, and Chairpersons and Executive Management of the entities. My name is Juleka Byatt. I'm Chair of the NHPRC, and it is my pleasure to be here today on behalf of the NHPRC to provide you with the annual report for the 2019-2020 financial year. Accompanying me today, Chair, is the CEO of the NHPRC, and we welcome him back, Mr. Nziwonke Dlamini. And I'm here also with the CFO of the NHPRC, Mr. Sonyiso Mvuyo. Chair, simply just to provide you with a few highlights, may I briefly just indicate the following to you. First of all, having reviewed the legislation which mandates the NHPRC, may I say that Cabinet approved the Housing Consumer Protection Bill and its subsequent publication in the Government Gazette for comments. That is a very important step for us, Chair. Secondly, the NHPRC has initiated the e-services for home builders and home and housing consumers. This is to ensure that the NHPRC services are accessible through the internet as well as through other applications. Thirdly, Chair, can I just say that issues related to women in construction are very important to the NHPRC. And in line with this, the NHPRC we partnered with a women-owned company to construct an innovative building technology home for an 80-year-old grandmother who lives with her two grandchildren in a dilapidated mud house in the Free State province. Important here also in highlighting a few issues to you, Chair, is that we were able to recover 2.6 million rand from defaulting home builders. Also, I just want to indicate that the NHPRC received an unqualified audit opinion for both the financial and non-financial performance. This, Chair, is a huge improvement from last year, and we're very happy for that. Finally, Chair, may I also advise you that there has been a very dedicated approach to address performance inefficiencies in the operations and the inspection methodologies of the NHPRC. In this regard, the Council of the NHPRC has approved a new operations and inspection model. Chair, we will soon be sharing these methodologies with the department, and then we will be very happy to come and report to you. I will stop there, Chair, and hand over to our CEO, Mr. Dlamini, to take us through the next step. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you. Let me recognize the Deputy Minister, the members of the committee, and the Director General. I will skip the areas that have already been covered. The presentation is structured in a manner that provides for the motto, mission, vision, and the delivery pillars of the programs that we are implementing and the foundational requirements. I think I'm not going to go through all of those. I think we've presented them before. Next one. From a governance perspective, NHPRC is operating with seven committees of council: the audit risk, the fund and finance committee, registration, industry advisory committee, which ensures that we coordinate with the industry, human capital and remuneration committee, social ethics and Disciplinary Hearing Committee. Some of these are required in terms of the law. The council was appointed by the minister on the 1st of August 2018, so I think it's in the last leg of its life. It consists of 12 experienced members with a good balance of skills and constituted by the following, by those committees. The distribution of those members is according to the skills of the various committees, skills mix of the members. Next one. I won't go through all the strategic objectives. I think we all know them, except to say that we maintain operational efficiencies, improve accessibility and visibility of the NHBRC products and services from an administrative perspective. The second program, which is regulation, deals with the regulation and compliance, and that's an area where if the bill is approved, we will be in a better position because there has been complaints that we do not have teeth. Those who do not comply, they choose to lose the money, little money that they are charged to continue with their business. So the Act is meant to increase that and so that we can be in a position to hit them in the pocket. Where our values are listed there, I'm not going to get through them in detail. Next one. Our products offerings are also well known. It's registration and renewal of registration, enrollment of homes in the subsidy and non-subsidy sector, inspection of subsidy and non-subsidy homes, training of home builders, women, youth brigade, military veterans, artisans, and all of those people with special needs. We will give statistics about what we are doing with regard to that. Geotechnical investigation assessments, and then resolution of complaints, conciliation between housing consumers and home builders. And then we provide legal and enforcement of norms and standards. Next one. Amongst the achievements, I think, which the chair has already indicated, is that we moved from 2017-18 from qualified audit with findings to last year an unqualified audit with findings. This year, we're still there, but the number of areas that the Auditor General is concerned about have reduced significantly. When it comes to the performance information, there's been a significant improvement from last year because last year we were qualified. Next one. As I indicated, we report that we have an improvement on both of those areas in the current year. The areas of concern, the major areas of concern that the Auditor General raised mainly are in area of compliance with laws and regulation and supply chain management and the existence of irregular expenditure. We will show the progress that we are making with the irregular expenditure when the CFO is presenting the financial statements. Next. Over the years, we come from a very low base in terms of achievement of performance in terms of the targets set in the APP from 38 to now 81. We seek to improve in the other areas of non-performance that we consider still areas of concern. And therefore, we are looking at improving on our performance going forward. Next. The previous slide, I think, was already addressed by the chair. When we look at the registration of home builders, you can see that it's fairly stable over the period, both the renewals and registrations. Next one. Over the past 5 years. The same in the late enrollments and enrollments of home builders. Next one. In the area of subsidy enrollments,
Hello. Call it off.
Mr. Boy.
Are you there?
Can you move? Can you move, call Mr. Boy? Hello, Chair.
Hello, yes. Chair.
I'm back.
Okay.
The area that is of concern, which in terms of future strategies is to be addressed, is the area of inspection of homes and how we account for it going forward. There's been some fluctuations and drops in the performance in this area, which we have to address. Thank you. Next one. Disciplinary matters over the 5 years have been increasing, which means we are picking up the problems that are occurring with home builders who do not comply, and we have been chasing them and being able to deal with them. We want to address this from a preventative perspective by improving our relationship with them, and then using the law, the new bill, to actually address this particular issue by hitting them in their pockets. Next one. Suspensions and defaulting home builders have been decreasing. I think the increase in the disciplinary hearings, disciplinary processes, is actually contributing to the less defaulting home builders, but we still think that there's quite a lot that of home builders that are defaulting even going forward. We have to pick them up very quickly. Next one. In terms of the workforce of the NHBRC, we have a workforce of 702. In 2015, it was 605. It has moved over the period. And of which 633 are permanent staff and temporary staff is 15. The permanent staff are mostly the inspectors and the people who go for legal compliance. Next one. Organizational performance, which has been in the APP, is reflected in the... I'll start with the social transformation and training. We have trained 5,723 female home builders, both young, emerging, technical professionals, military veterans, and all the information is given there. And the total for the year is 9,554. Next one. Next one. Right. We're going by KPA. I will just address only those that require to be. I think that are problematic and indicate where we have achieved as well. We set ourselves a yearly target in the maintenance of our network availability, because it's absolutely important that our network is available for people to access our service. We set it at 99%, and we achieved 98%. The contributors to that 1% are instances of load shedding. And then we maintained subsystem availability at 99.88%, which matched the target that we had set ourselves. We then achieved the implementation of our human capital plan, 100%. And then I'll leave the other targets. Go to the next page. Under Program 2, Regulation and Protection, we have met the targets on home builders to be registered and home builders for renewal, and then did not meet the home builders for inspection, which is something I've already addressed. And a number of homes inspected in both the subsidy and the non-subsidy sector. And then we've met the matter that relates to prosecution. Hence, you see that we've been able to succeed in getting an increase in the penalties that we have levied. But in some cases, the target, which is a qualitative target of meeting prosecutable matters set down for hearing before the DC within 120 days, has not been met. And that is because of the inherent nature of disciplinary hearings. And many times there are postponements, etc., that occur when these disciplinary hearings are set. Next one. Next. Okay. Yeah. In the areas research and training, we planned to conduct a study on the impact of NHBRC building training within the home building environment. That has been achieved. There is a report on that. We also plan to complete a design of the Green Edge rated compliant IPT house as per the project plan, which will then test next year, so that we can look at the efficacy of the thermal performance of those new and the products that are being used to actually achieve those. And then in the training environment, which I have already indicated, we had set ourselves to train 2,400 home builders, and we met the target because we trained 3,145. In the youth environment, we exceeded the target by 214. In the women to be trained, we achieved the target. We had set ourselves 1,980, we achieved 2,021. In the military environment space, a target that we had always been struggling in the past we have met the target this time because we have been engaging with the Department of Military Veterans and even signed an MOU with them. And then a number of people with disabilities, 284 against 265. Next one. And then a number of technical professionals to be trained were targeted at 695. We achieved that by delivering 891. We had planned 500 artisans to be trained. We delivered 514 and we achieved the target. Next one. Number of homes to be enrolled was targeted at 63. We achieved 69. 50 homes to be enrolled in a non-subsidy sector, which is driven by the market to a large extent. We achieved 48. The variance is small. And then implementation of the communication plan. Yeah, I think the technology sometimes can leave you in a leash. I'm going to hand over to the CFO to present the financial statements and comment on the audit issues that are critical.
Thank you. Thank you, CEO. Good afternoon, Chairperson. And the members of the committee, Deputy Minister, chairpersons of the boards, DG, and colleagues. Earlier when the chair started with the presentation in her introduction, she did highlight that in year 1920, we got an unqualified audit opinion, both on our performance information as well as on our financial statements. I think what stood between us and getting a clean audit were the two areas that the CEO touched on. Number one, which is the non-compliance with laws and legislation, which then resulted in some irregular expenditure that we then reported on, which is reflected on the audit report in our annual report. Later on, Chair, in my submission, there is a slide that talks to the progress. Firstly, it reflects on where we come from with irregular expenditure, as well as touches on the progress that the NHBRC and Council we have made in attempting to deal with this area within our supply chain management area. Now, in terms of the financial statements, I'll just briefly summarize how we have performed financially. CEO has touched on the non-finances.
Yeah,
it has frozen on my side, but I can continue talking, Chair. I've got the presentation in front of me. In terms of the overall net profit that we've reported on, it's 137, which is quite low from the number that we reported on last year. I will touch on that, Chair, when I get onto the income statement, which is summarized. The investment portfolio on a year-on-year grew by 177 million, which is quite less than the number that we saw in the last financial year. When the year started, we were optimistic that the growth on the portfolio would actually exceed what we saw in the prior year. However, when we got into the fourth quarter from January to March, that's when we started seeing the markets reacting now to all issues around COVID. That then affected our portfolios and they delivered negative returns in the fourth quarter. In terms of our cash flow, the cash that was generated from our operations was at 139 million, which is quite less than what we saw in the prior year. In the prior year, we reported 207 million from our operations. The total income end that we wrote for the year is 924 against a budget of 954.
So we came below budget. An area of concern, Chair, has been an issue around our operational expenditure. The Chairperson did highlight earlier that as a result of identifying a lot of inefficiencies within our operations, we therefore had to relook and revise the operating model of the NHPRC, looking at our overall operations as well as how that then affects the inspection process. Now, in terms of on the next slide, Chair, it's a reflection now of the previous 5 years audited in terms of the revenues that we generated, the costs associated with that, as well as the net investment income, giving us an overall surplus over the years. If one then compares how the NHPRC fared over the years, I think 2019 was the year where we had quite a good performance in as far as the revenues that we had reported. In 2020, those came down. In the year that we are on now, with the impact of COVID-19 on our operations project, that number would be quite low. Looking at the operational expenditure, this is an area that council has raised some concerns about. So we've just concluded an exercise now where we were looking at the sustainability model of the organization going forward. That product of that exercise is part of the operating model that will be shared with the Department of Human Settlements and if needs be with the members of the portfolio committee as well. And then moving on to our balance sheet, Chair. As at the end of March 2020, the NHPRC has got quite a healthy balance sheet in the sense that our asset base on a year-on-year grew by 3%, our equities by 2.4%, and our liabilities, which are valued by our actuaries. These are the liabilities that belong to the warrant fund. So these are valued by actuaries at each financial year end. So those ones, they went up by 6%. And then if one looks at our cash flow, I did touch on the fact that the cash that we generated from our operations in 2019 was less than what we saw coming through in the prior year, purely because of the decreased revenues in the year as well as the increase in the operational expenditure. And then, Chair, in the investment portfolio at the end of March was sitting at around 6.8 billion. It has since grew from there to around 7.2 at the end of October. And the liabilities associated with that is around 1.4 billion. So the report that talks to the solvency valuation of the fund has been submitted to the department, as well as there was a request from National Treasury for us to submit that report to them as well, of which we have done so. Now, Chair, the issue that I touched on earlier when I started is the issue around the irregular expenditure, which we have reported from the year 2011. Now, these are legacy contracts that were entered into in those years without following the correct SCM process as legislated, which then resulted in the NHPRC reporting irregular expenditure. Now, that irregular expenditure peaked in between the year 2014, 15, and 16. Now, that then necessitated that the NHPRC does a maturity assessment of its own supply chain management function, of which we did, to identify all the gaps within that function and try then and come up with strategies that are going to help us to try and manage this area. The first one was to ensure that we have a policy that is aligned to national treasury regulations. However, there were some gaps identified by the AG this year, of which we are working on trying to close those gaps. The second one was ensuring that we develop standard operating procedures, have our employees within the area trained on all the laws affecting SCM. Now, the case is that if one looks at our annual report, Chairperson, the total cumulative number from 2011, around 711 million. Of the 711 million, 565 was investigated. There were recommendations made out of those reports. Those were then implemented as recommended. And we then submitted an application to National Treasury for condonation. That process has not yet been concluded. However, we are making progress to ensure that come the end of this current financial year, we've closed on that one that was initially applied for condemnation. And the remainder of the balance that has not yet been submitted, we are in the process of working on that one, Chair, with a plan of achieving a clean audit come the end of March 2020. So that then brings me to the end of my presentation, Chairperson, and I apologize that I could not be able to scroll the slides have frozen on my machine. Thank you very much, Chair.
Chair, may I, with your permission, just close?
Yes.
May I, Chairperson, thank you very much. And may I say thank you to you and to the members of present for this opportunity. And may I also just advise you, Chair, that based on the new operations and inspections model, we are looking at a more appropriate and fit-for-purpose organogram. Chair, once this process has undergone the necessary governance processes, the department will be informed, and we'll be happy to inform you as well. Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, and we look forward and we await any questions that members might have. Thank you very much.
Just a small comment, Chair, on the irregular expenditure. We're working very hard to liaise with National Treasury because when we went to National Treasury, it was quite some time ago. Then the chief procurement officer left National Treasury, and therefore we have to now engage the new one. But we are going to try and work towards cleaning the past problems on the irregular expenditure.
Thank you very much for the presentation. I'm now going to open for members to interact with the presentation. Members, can we raise hands so that I can note you because of this poor network? I see only one hand.
They are tired, Chair.
Yes, we have Honorable Rebecca Mosala, number one. Number two, Honorable Seki. Number three, Honorable Sutwai. Number four, Honorable Powell. Number five, Honorable Tafeni. As I've indicated, can members continue?
Honorable Mosala, thanks so much, Chairperson. My first question is going to be with regard to the issue of transformation. The transformation in the EAAD is a problem. Majority of the
Honorable Mosala, sorry, Honorable Mosala, somebody has opened the mic. Is it your background or somebody?
Sorry about that.
Okay, proceed.
Can you hear me, Chair? I'm just going to put one question. It's with regards to the issue of transformation in the EAAD. There's no transformation at all. Majority of the state, state agents are run by the white minority.
Hello, Chair.
Honorable Mosala, we have lost you.
It's like he's done, Chair. He said she's going to talk on one issue.
Honorable, thank you.
Thank you very much, Chair. I don't know.
Honorable members, can we mute our mic? Please. Proceed.
Tell them what bus to Melanatimalice. Chairperson, I'm not sure whether I missed the opening remarks of the chair in relation to the acting positions, if that can be commented on EAAB. Could hear what is the way forward on the acting positions. I think the issue of devaluation of assets, it will be important for us to continuously get feedback on the challenge that the entity is going to do. I've got a question here, Chair, that says, why a drop on the estate agents? The number of the estate agents is dropping over the years. What could be the reason? Maybe I've missed it. On the transformation, I really want to appreciate the intention of EAB on the areas of its transformation, Chair. But there's a point there which I'm a little bit skeptical on it. It says reduce illegal estate agents. The word reduce doesn't say eradicate. Does it mean that traditionally within the estate agent will always have illegal people? Can they expand on that? It goes again to rehabilitation of regularization and rehabilitation of the old estate agents for them to be in the incubation so that they could continue to practice legally. To me, those two are contradictory to the mission and the vision of the department and the entity. The increasing matters in relation to disciplinary hearings over the 5 years, it shows that there's a serious disciplinary process, which we can't just appreciate, but we must know. You know, some of the things they are exposed, you'll find that they've been happening, but there was no one who's dealing with them. Now probably they are exposed, they've been there, the rot has been there for those that are doing wrong for many years. Maybe now the entity is coming to terms with its own operations. Thank you, Chair. Yeah, Chair, I'm done, although I was talking so much.
Okay, Honorable,
thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much. I just still need to get a feel from the source. We had reports from SOS, I think last year and early this year. But one is not getting a feel that the stability in terms of its structure. The stability in terms of its structure. As they're presenting, one is trying to get a grip of stability in terms of structure. If perhaps I've missed that, I will apologize, but can I get such a tool? The NHBRC Unfortunately, NHBRC, or fortunately, we had a report from the AG, and I was listening as NHBRC is presenting. I'm not getting some of the issues that were interesting in that report. There is an amount of 711.5 million that the NHBRC is grappling to get a trace of that money, but the money is in the coffers of NHBRC. Perhaps if we can get from the horse's mouth of what was that, where did it come from, and then what is happening about that. There's an issue of the ethical conduct. I think the CEO also raised the issue that there's a process now of disciplinary hearings, but you're not getting what is it? What did they do? What are the content of this unethical conduct that is done? Is it by the builders? Is it by the officials? Is it by who? And the process of a disciplinary hearing that is happening. The CEO raised the issue that the AG has identified gaps. I was listening. What are these gaps? Let alone the issues that I've raised. What are these gaps that the AG has identified? One of the critical areas, Chair, I was also listening to the department. One of the critical issues is that NHBRC has got a responsibility to monitor and protect the homeowners in terms of the quality house. The quality house. You're not getting the reality of that as the presenter has been presenting. Maybe it's because of the time constraints. You're not getting that. Is this there and how big it is? And then what becomes a recovery plan? I heard that there's money that has been recovered from the builders in terms of work that has been done within the program. So can we get clarity on these issues? I apologize, Chair, because the presenter was not, she was rushing to another point, just raise issues. You have got an interest to understand, and you are not getting exactly. This is why I'm asking questions like this. Thank you, Chair.
Honorable Power.
Thanks, Chairperson. Let's just go back to the Auditor General's report from Friday. And in the AG's report, I'm going to start with the EAAB and then move on to CSOS. So the EAAB received qualified opinions as a result of the inadequate controls and processes around revenue management. And the AG also noted that the EAAB still doesn't have a CFO. It noted that revenue was materially understated as penalties for late renewals of Fidelity Fund certificates by state agencies were not always raised. It also noted that there were no or limited assurances provided by senior management, the accounting officer, and the internal audit committee. Now, these are all issues that when we previously met with the EAAB, we raised as red flags and we were told we're under control. Now we've got findings from the AG. We were also told that there were material findings in relation to the EAAB in relation to procurement, where the AG stated that awards were awarded without inviting the prescribed number of quotations. Now that's a simple function of any State Department, is to comply with supply chain management regulation. And I listened very carefully to the presentation given by the EAAB, and I'm not satisfied that we've, as a committee, been given enough information in relation to these irregular procurement processes. How can a state entity award a contract without inviting the prescribed number of quotations? So my questions to the EAAB are that while revenue has been materially understated, and we heard from the CEO that she personally disagrees, the penalties for late renewals of Fidelity Fund certificates were not always raised. Were they raised but simply not reflected? Can we please have a little bit more clarity on that? Then could we also have details in some depth about these quotations around procurement? Were these in relation to legal contracts, because we've seen those flagged before? What were they in relation to IT? We know there's huge problems with IT at the EAAB that are in process. I'm told a tender was awarded in August. And then my last question is, last year, certificates were issued too late to estate agents due to system failures. And so many agents across South Africa were without certificates and were unable to generate an income in January this year. Can the CEO give this portfolio committee and Parliament her firm commitment that there will be no such issues again as of the beginning of next year, and that all certificates will be issued on time? And then just an anecdotal question that doesn't have to do specifically with the AG's report and the annual report, is that I've been inundated over the past couple of weeks by estate agents from across South Africa who are escalating to me as a member of Parliament concerns with the EAAB not answering their telephones. Apparently the office in Cape Town has got some serious problems. I've been sent an affidavit in that regard. The IT systems not working, calls not being returned. Can we please just hear from the CEO what is being done to capacitate staff at the EAAB and to ensure that there is at least an acceptable level of customer service? Because what we get told here as a committee differs certainly from the complaints that we receive as MPs. So that's for the EAAB. Now back to CSOS. So again, on Friday, the CSOS received a qualified opinion as a result, again, of inadequate controls and processes. CSOS, we're told, also doesn't have a CFO. And we've heard that not all levies from community schemes were identified and collected. Can the CEO of CSOS or the chairperson of the board tell us, has the longstanding matter of the suspension of the previous chief ombud and financial officer been resolved? Are those positions filled? The term of the acting chief ombud, according to information sent to me by the minister this year, was an advocate Letele, ended in April 2019. Now, on the information sent to me by the minister when I asked for the incumbents in all of those positions, there was no updated position other than advocate Letele. So can we just please get some information as to whether or not the chief ombud position has been filled? And then Also, there was talk now by one of the officials on planned amendments to the Act. Can CSOS give us some information on what the envisaged amendments will look like and what they seek to remedy? I know that there are concerns from certain sectors of society around regional ombuds not adhering to regulations, etc. And there's, I think, a lot of stuff that goes wrong can potentially be amended through the promulgation of new regulations as opposed to the amendment of the Act. So we'd be quite interested just to understand what planned amendments are in the pipelines from CSOS. That's all from me. Thank you, Chairperson.
Honourable Tuffin.
Thank you, Chairperson. Chairperson, I want to ask on the EAAB report. EAAB and the Department of Human Settlement, on why are they taking so long to finalize the regulations as the Act was promulgated to 2 years ago? The lack of these regulations is hindering the work of the estate agents, especially the previous disadvantaged ones. And number two, the Property Practitioners Regulatory Bill was published, gazetted on the 31 March 2017 and signed into Act on the 19 September 2019. Given these developments, when is the board to translate from the old EAAB into the new Property Practitioners Regulatory Agents? Number three, the annual report shows areas that need further enhancement. One such area is the revenue recognition, which has resulted in qualifications in the books of the EAAB. What measures have been put in place to ensure that audit outcomes are further improved? I thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you very much, honourable members. I see some members, their hands are still up. Honourable Sukai?
No, Chair.
Okay, can you lower your hands?
Okay.
Okay, thank you very much. Just to add on the questions, on the EAAB, Auditor General record the regression on the SCM on compliance. I think if you can comment on that and what might be the is it the systematic problem or is the issue that is being raised by honourable member. Because Auditor General even raised that some of the tenders are awarded even when the contract has been lapsed, which is a big irregularities. And if you can just get the reasons, it's both the EAAB and the CSOS. And just to emphasize that there is no goodness in from whether it's adverse or disclaimer to qualify. So we will appreciate the unqualified at least, and because our view is that so far we should move towards clean audit. And both the two entities have not appointed the CFOs and Auditor General indicate that posts were advertised in some instances, but the delay of finalizing the processes even made it that those posts not being filled. Can we get commitment on the appointment of those critical positions, particularly of CFOs. When do we expect those posts to be filled, and then whether we've lost money in the process of those advertising and allowing the processes to lapse or not finalizing them, and we end up restarting the process. And on the NHBRC, welcoming the report and the good progress that you are making, but just to raise the issue that the Auditor General has raised as a risk, and we have raised it even in the last financial year in terms of houses that we enrolled, particularly those that are awarded by the state, because those are the houses that need to be protected in terms of the quality. And in the previous financial year, there was no indication of the a choice from various contractors for them to enroll those houses. Just to check, the department might even come. How do we secure that all the houses that have been built by the state are enrolled with the NHBRC? Because this issue has been raised as a risk by Auditor General, particularly looking at areas where we have not performed very well, your Northwest, where some of the houses people left without at the level of slabs. And there are a lot of, if you go throughout the provinces, you might find the similar areas. And if all the houses were registered or enrolled with the NHBRC, probably we could have noticed that something is going wrong and attended to it. So those are the questions that I wanted to ask. Can we then get responses? And welcome the transformation element in the EAB, but much needs to be done, as Honorable Mohlala is indicating, that if you still have 10,000 white visas, 1,000, the journey is still long, so we need to actually to put targets. What is it that we, our intention of this transformation, at what level do we want to reach? But it's not that we are not acknowledging those milestones that you have achieved, but the worry is the gap and the people that they, as you are saying, this is one of the entity that or the state agency that the young people has developed interest in, probably through your education forum. But the question is, what is it that you do to make sure that we don't lose them in the system? They come in and we lose them in the system. Those are the questions. Can we get a response? We'll start with the CISOs, the way you have presented. CISOs?
Thank you, Chair. I'll start with the question that came from Member Zifai relating to the stability of the organization. It is correct that we were sitting with vacancies in the previous financial year. more particularly on executive level. What we have done is most of those positions have been filled, and what we've also done is we've prioritized the filling of vacancies within the core, which is the dispute resolution and governance. Majority of the managerial positions have also been filled. So in terms of the vacancy rate, which will then assist us in terms of ensuring that there is stability, we have decreased by 30% by end of financial year. In terms of the current financial year, we've also further advertised more positions, which then saw the reduction of the vacancy by further almost 40%. So in terms of ensuring that the organization is capacitated, I think we are fairly there, and we are achieving that target to ensure that at least most of the strategic positions are filled. Then on the issue, the question that was raised by Ms. Powell in terms of the amendment of the CISOS Act, what I can indicate is that we are looking at the governance within the community schemes in terms of strengthening that. Also, the dispute resolution process as set out in the Act currently is not adequate. So one of the amendments will augment the entire process for dispute resolution. We did indicate that we can do so by providing that in the regulation that would be done. However, our Act requires that any amendment to the regulation has to be tabled in Parliament. So we will be submitting both the amendment and the regulation simultaneously to Parliament for consideration and approval. And we are hoping with the amendment will strengthen the entire dispute resolution process, strengthen more particularly the process relating to appeal of the adjudication order by the members of the body corporate, because that is one area that is lacking. And also in terms of the procedure that needs to be followed when the schemes do submit their dispute from lodging the dispute until finalization. So we are also envisaging having a provision that will allow for internal review of the adjudication order. The internal review will also minimize the need for body corporate or members of the community scheme approaching court for the review or appeal of the CISOS adjudication order. That will then assist them in terms of the cost containment, because if they have to go to court, then they have to incur the legal costs relating to that process. So the amendment will obviously ensure that there is efficiency, there is clear instruction in terms of what needs to be done, what needs to happen within the entire value chain for dispute resolution process. Thank you. I will hand over to the chair of the board to deal with the issue of the appointment of the CFO in the chief.
Thank you, CFO, CEO. With regard to the two positions, it is true that they've been vacant for quite for the better part of the year. And we finally managed to interview both positions and made our selections and recommendations in terms of the Act. So we are awaiting the outcome of those two positions. So we are hoping that we will hear by the end of this month in terms of going ahead with the appointment. Thanks.
On the NHBRC, the question that was asked.
In the order, EAB.
Oh.
Wait, EAB.
Okay, thank you very much, Chairperson. Chairperson, we'll deal with the questions in reverse order, and I see we do have the lion's share of the questions, but we'll try our best to deal with them succinctly. Chairperson, I'd like to start with the questions that you asked, Chairperson. You specifically raised the issue that the AGS said there's been a regression in relation to the SCM, in relation to SCM compliance within the EAB. I think it's quite regrettable that that has been presented in that fashion, because that's not a full factually accurate.
And the reason I'm saying this is because what the AG has been referring to is the cancellation of 3 contracts during the financial year. And these are contracts that emanate from the 2017-2018 financial year. As part of our cleaning up to make sure that the institution is run efficiently, we then have come in and we've cancelled contracts where we felt that there was either irregularity with regard to the procurement of those contracts or where there was irregularity with regard to the procurement of the tender process. The first contract that was cancelled was the one for SABNT, which was the internal auditors. We found that there was direct interference from one of the board committees with regard to the appointment of the specific service provider. And as management, even before the audit process commenced, we then set in motion a process to cancel that contract, and this was then reported to the AG by management. It wasn't a process which was picked up by the AG. It was something that was picked up by management, and it emanated from 2 financial years prior. And we then obviously made sure that we clean up and make sure that no further payments are made, because further payments to this company would have amounted to irregular expenditure. The second contract was in relation to Blue Key. This is a contract that was not picked up by the AG, but was also picked up by management emanating from the previous financial year. It was in relation to a service provider that was appointed to provide SAP services. We actually realized that in relation to that particular service provider, 3 quotes were not obtained. We then took it upon ourselves as management not to continue to make any payments to that service provider, and the contract was actually cancelled. The third contract is also linked to the SAP service provider. It relates to a company called Baruch. We also found that this was a small one-man trader that was responsible for the entire database for the EAB in relation to estate agents. And we found that each time that we were asking for access to our own database, which should have been housed within the EAB, were being charged. And we also found that their appointment of this particular company was irregular, and we cancelled it. And now we have regularized the operation, which makes it a lot easier for the EAB to then administer the estate agents and to have our own database. The other factor, the other consequence of actually appointing the service provider was linked to the issue of the Fidelity Fund certificates. We were finding that there was difficulties with regard to issuing Fidelity Fund certificates timely because our database was sitting in the hands of a third party. And that is why we had to cancel that particular contract. And when the AG came to audit, we had already canceled that contract. So it was all part of our cleanup mechanism. So I think it must be understood in its fullest context that those were the circumstances under which those contracts were cancelled. They were cancelled by management. It wasn't as a consequence of the intervention by the AG. We had to obviously notify the AG as part of our reporting requirements. But most importantly, these irregular appointments had been undertaken in the previous financial year, which was 2017-2018. The other issue, Chair, in relation to supply chain management, there is an assertion that there has been appointment of service providers without obtaining 3 quotes in terms of the RFQ process. I'd really like to indicate that that is not factually correct. We can obviously bring all the evidence forth for the committee to have a look at, because during the financial year 2019-2020, all service providers that were appointed during using an RFQ process have been appointed with the relevant 3 quotes. Initially, the personnel of the AG had indicated that they believed that we had not provided the 3 quotes. We then showed them that in terms of the information that we had submitted, if they undertook a more closer analysis, they were going to pick up that actually 3 quotes had been provided. And when we presented and showed them that if they analyze the information provided more closely, they would see the 3 quotes. They then accepted that, and that matter was no longer an issue. So we are taken aback that that has been raised here, but all the information is fully documented, and we know that that issue was cleared with the officials of the AG. I'm just not sure whether within their reporting structures, maybe this was not then escalated to Dadel on the Loza. But that was cleared with the personnel from the AG. And the acting CFO is in this meeting, and she can clarify exactly who it is. She clarified. She gave the information to, and she even further elaborated on the information, and this information was accepted. And as such, we do not believe that there's been a regression. In fact, we have intensified our detection mechanisms, and this has fully been resumed. We have cleaned up in relation to the SCM and process. And we, on the issue of the unqualified audit chairperson and all honorable members, we as EAB fully would want an unqualified audit, and we have pushed very hard from last financial year, even this financial year. We have pushed very hard to have an unqualified audit, but obviously the final word does sit with the AG in relation to these matters. But we do believe that we have been qualified on issues that really we do not believe should be qualifying matters. But as I've already said, we have to obviously defer to the final authority of the AG. And in each case, we have been qualified on one issue. But that doesn't mean, obviously, there are not other issues where the AG has made recommendation on better administration to the EAB, and we obviously take those into account. But when it comes to the qualifying issues, in each financial year, we have been qualified on one issue. The issue about the appointment of this, the CFO, the process was that we had already advertised, and the process for appointment of a CFO, permanent CFO, was at an advanced stage. We had already even appointed a service provider to assist with facilitation of the process. We were then notified by the minister's office that there would be a secondment of a CFO from one of the other entities. And I believe that this communication was with the chairperson's office. And I will ask the deputy chair if he feels so inclined to make input, because I know that the issue around the secondment is being discussed with the chairperson's office. But that's where we are. And then in relation to issues of whether or not there's been irregular expenditure as a consequence of the processes that we've undertaken, I do believe that the chairperson of the board did write to the Honourable Minister's office to indicate how far the process was, and to obviously get guidance from the minister as to whether we abandon the process that had already been started by the EAB and abide by the secondment, or we get advice from the minister on whether the secondment would proceed. But I will request that the deputy chair maybe speak to the matter in greater detail. On the issue, I think then the honourable member Tafeni spoke to the issue around the regulations. Honourable member, the issue around the regulation making process, I'm sure you do know that the EAB obviously provides a input and support in relation to that process, but it is a process that sits with the executive authority. And I do believe that during the COVID period, obviously there was a bit of a lull in relation to the regulation making process, but I do believe that the process is now in full swing. All public engagements are being undertaken, and the EAB and all other relevant stakeholders in the sector are fully participating in that process. And we would obviously want to see that it is finalized as soon as possible. But I also want to just indicate, honourable member, that yes, the Property Practitioners Act was promulgated into law, but the president has not provided an effect. The state president has not as yet provided an effective date, and as such, we are still waiting His Excellency the President of the Republic to indicate when will the effective date be for the operation of the Act. So between the date of promulgation and the effective date, what is then expected is that as the regulator, we start preparing our systems and putting systems in place in anticipation of the effective date. Because once we have an effective date, then it comes into full force and all systems must run. We have, on our part as the regulator, in preparation for the effective date, already started consultation with the other additional sectors that will be coming into the fold, principally your bond originators, your bond brokers, your auctioneers, your managing agents. So the discussions have already started. We've been speaking to them about the registration system, the licensing regime that will come into force under this Act. We've been speaking to them about educational material, who will be the final arbiter with regard to providing educational material, continuous professional development. We've also been speaking to them around issues of enforcement and regulation. We do anticipate that with the unregulated sectors, for instance, your property developers, your bond originators and your auctioneers, there may be certain challenges because now they will have to have will be regulated full force, which in previously they were not. So we do expect that we would also have to undertake analysis of the status quo as to how many entities exist, who we need to collect from, the method by which we will collect, and the method of licensing. But we don't think it's an insurmountable task. As I've already indicated, we are in the process of already consulting with them. The department has already also asked us to present them with a strategy and an organogram that will utilize in under the new regime. We are working on it, and we do believe that in the first week of December, we should be able to provide both the strategy and the new organogram that would work in terms of the environment of the Property Practitioners Act. Even other softer issues like the logo, the look and the feel of the Property Practitioners Regulatory Authority, we've already worked on that. And once the strategy is complete, we intend on presenting all that to the board and also presenting it to the Department of Human Settlements for them to also agree and that we are at Eden. The only challenge that will still befall us, and we do believe that we'll still have further engagement with the department in relation to, is how are we going to fund this extended mandate? Because at the end of the day, the money that the EAB currently holds is that which has been contributed by the Eastern agents, because I'm sure you know that we are not funded from the fiscus, but we are funded from contributions of our members. So we feel that it would obviously be a bit of a challenge to fund the new sectors through money that has been contributed by the estate agency sector. So in terms of the Property Practitioners Act, it does specify that we would be entitled to ask for money from the fiscus. So we will be making a submission to the department to ask for additional funding from the fiscus in relation to this extended mandate, so that we are not then accused of cross-pollinating in terms of the funding that we have within the EAB. The next set of questions came from the honourable member Powell. The member raised the issue about the qualified opinions and the issue of revenue management and the issue about understating the penalties. I do believe that the CFO and I have been at great pains to indicate that, yes, there has been that finding by the AG, and that is the basis for our qualification. But I will ask the acting CFO to maybe speak to the technicalities around the specific qualification. But in simple terms, from our understanding, what is being said here is that we have under-collected in terms of the penalties that were issued. And as a consequence of that, the AG actually feels that we should have stated the penalties at a higher amount, but we have actually understated those penalties. We obviously did engage with the AG, and we even went to the extent of adopting alternative audit procedures where they actually called the specific estate agents to get confirmation. They called the estate agents from a sample that they extracted to get confirmation around whether or not penalties had been imposed on those particular estate agents and whether they were deregistered and re-registered. They did get the confirmation, but we do believe that it wasn't to their satisfaction. But in the course of those engagements, there was a reduction, because the initial finding by the AG on the understatement was in the region of 12 million. But after further engagements with the EAB, it was then reduced to 2.4 million, which then I think is an indication that we made every effort and every endeavor in our power to actually reduce that amount. But obviously, the AG was not fully satisfied, and we did not meet their materiality framework in relation to the reduction of the quantum. Have we met their materiality framework or gone below their materiality framework in relation to the quantum, then we believe we would have had an unqualified audit. And I think we're just 1.3 million off the mark. In relation to not having a CFO, I think I have already spoken to that issue. The member also raised that the AG indicated that there were no assurances from senior management, CFO, and the Audit Tenders Committee. I do think, Chair, that the AG, in the context of reporting on that matter, would have also raised the issue that there was some delays in relation to providing minutes of different committees, but I do believe that eventually those minutes were provided. And I do believe that it is an administrative issue, and it does go to issues around assurance, but I do believe that eventually, even though there were delays with regard to providing the minutes of some of these committees, these minutes were eventually provided, and I believe from the reading and the contents of those minutes, the AG did get the assurance that there was no impropriety or any attempt to conceal any impropriety within the institution. It was merely an administrative issue in relation to the preparation and the timelines of preparing the minutes. I think I have spoken to the issue that that was raised by both the chairperson and Member Powell around the procurement. There was also the question that the member raised around the IT system. I just want to indicate that the member indicated that the IT system, there was an award in August. I think I just need to correct that, honourable member, that the tender process closed in August. And we're still in the process of evaluation and adjudication so that an award can be made. But we are quite positive that before the end of this calendar year, there will be a service provider that will be in place to deal with the ERP system, which is our IT system. And this will be the first time in many years. And I'm sure you all know that the IT system that we currently have at the EAB is wholly outdated and does not meet the needs of the growth of the industry. And as such, that is why the ERP process was undertaken. And we do believe that once it is in place, within a period of 3 years, we should fully phase it in. And there will be a marked difference in relation to the deliverables of the EAB. Flowing on from the IT system, I think, is the Fidelity Fund certificates and the issuance of the Fidelity Fund certificates. Again, I would also like to place on record that the issue around the Fidelity Fund certificates being issued after October last year is correct, but all Fidelity Fund certificates were issued by the 31st of December 2019. And I want to just indicate it was all compliant Fidelity Fund certificates, because you do find that there are people who apply for renewals or new Fidelity Fund certificates, but they don't meet the compliance requirements, meaning the documents that are required to be attached to the applications are not all attached. And in such a case, despite our best efforts, we cannot issue a Fidelity Fund certificate because there must be full compliance before we can issue one. But with regard to all compliant Fidelity Fund certificates, I can confirm before this committee that by the 31st of December 2019, all those were issued. And even in this financial year, we give a firm undertaking that all Fidelity Fund certificates that are compliant and that meet all the requirements will be issued by the 31st of December 2020. I want to also indicate that we are working full steam ahead in an attempt to make sure that we even bring back the date of issuance of those Fidelity Fund certificates a lot earlier than last year. We have a full team that is on board. We are working with our IT system, even though we have not migrated to the new ERP system. We are working with the IT system as it stands to make sure that Fidelity Fund certificates are issued, because we fully know more than anyone else that the Fidelity Fund certificate is a tool of trade of any estate agent. And if we do not give them that, then we are actually doing their business a huge disservice. Even in my presentation, I spoke to the fact that Fidelity Fund certificates are quite critical. The other issue around the call sent about telephones not being answered, IT systems not working. As I've already indicated, Chairperson, we are doing our level best to make sure that everything works fully. The issue about the telephones not being answered, I'm not sure which period the honourable member is speaking to, because as far as I know, yes, during the hard lockdown level 5, all systems were closed down within the EAB, but there was communication on our website indicating as to how people can contact us electronically, and people were working remotely. But once we moved to level 4, the contracted call center agents were then went off site in full compliance with the regulations, continued to receive calls and complaints were processed. And as far as I know, according to the monthly reports with regard that we receive in relation to complaints resolution, we believe that at least 96% of the complaints that come through our system are resolved timelessly, or at least there is an acknowledgement of that complaint and a timeline is attached to the resolution time in relation to those complaints. So there are sessions around the call center, and there are sessions around that the IT system problems within the institution. I do believe that those are being remedied and those are being dealt with. The other issue, which obviously arose within this financial year, is that because of lockdown or because of COVID, we've now had to start working with things remotely, and I'm glad to announce that our exams started this week, and they're now being provided online. And I received a report shortly before coming to this presentation that 98% of the people who wrote the exam actually did submit. The 2% that did not submit are those people who had challenges with regard to utilization of ICTs, and as such, that there's little much that the EAB can do, because we did provide training prior to expecting people to sit there for the exam, and as such, it would seem that there's some, even with the training that was provided by the EAB, who are not able to fully complete the examinations. But because of the regulations and the requirements, we unfortunately have to provide the examinations electronically, and we will also be giving a comprehensive report to our board in relation to that. But we do believe that it has been a success, and we are awaiting the outcome of those exams. And then just, I think then there were two further questions by honourable members. I think honourable member Seki also asked questions around the acting positions. Honourable member, in relation to the acting positions, that is true. There are four vacant executive positions at the EAB. The CFO one I've already spoken to quite comprehensively. There is also the position of executive corporate services that is vacant, the executive transformation that is vacant, and the executive enforcement and compliance. I'd like to start with enforcement and compliance. That only became vacant in February this year, and we have already advertised, and we're looking forward to actually filling the position before the end of this calendar year. With the executive transformation, that is a position that became vacant 2 years ago when the incumbent was seconded to the Department of Human Settlements. But the issue around whether we can fill the position or not, I think, has now been resolved by the board, and we're going full steam ahead in relation to filling that particular position. And we also have made a commitment to the department that this position will be filled within the 90 days. The same will also go for corporate services, whereby the position will be filled in 90 days. But in the interim, we have also filled other executive positions where we did not have permanent placements. We have filled the position of the chief risk officer. We have filled the position of the chief information officer. And we have also filled the position of the human resource manager. And we are going full steam ahead with regard to filling the other three vacant positions that have been enunciated. The issue around the devaluation of the assets, I'm going to ask the CFO to speak to that. Then Honourable Seki also raised the issue about the drop in the number of estate agents. Member, I really do believe that there are many factors that come to bear in relation to the drop in the number of estate agents, but we do believe that the economic downturn that I spoke to that actually befell the property sector even before the COVID epidemic has had an impact with regard to the drop in the number of estate agents. But we do believe that we will see a pickup in relation to the number of estate agents because of the transformation initiatives we've put in place, especially the implementation of the PDI resolution, because the unfortunate effect of regulation is that sometimes people who feel that they're being overly regulated then go into the illegal space and continue to trade. So we believe with the PDI resolution, where we're saying to estate agents out there that we because there's a suggestion that we are going to be relaxing even the compliance requirements. No, there will be no relaxation of that. All we are saying is in relation to the payments that you need to make for registrations, in relation to exams, in relation to education and training and CPD, we will give you an exemption if you come and put a convincing case before the EAB that you're entitled to an exemption. So we believe that with regard to those applications, and we have received over 800 applications in relation to that, we believe that with the processing of those applications, we are likely to see a huge increase in the number, not only of estate agents that will register in this financial year, but also in relation to the number of Black estate agents. And when I talk to 700 or 800, that is exclusively Black estate agents that have applied for the exemption, because the exemption only applies to Black estate agents. And when I talk Black, I'm talking in the broad sense of the word, which would be your African Black, your colored and your Indian South African. So we expect that will increase. But there are other barriers to entry, the issues around access to bonds, the issue around access to markets. And I think when I spoke to the transformation initiative, I spoke to the fact that the EAB is trying very hard to identify the barriers to entry and then put in place solutions to try and deal with those barriers to entry. And as I've already stated, the issue of access to markets is a very big one, because you won't stay as an estate agent if you cannot sell, if you cannot secure stock. That's why we're talking to state entities that have an obligation to make sure transformation is a success. We're talking to Public Works, it has a huge stock of housing, it has a huge stock in relation to properties. We're talking to Department of Rural Development. I mean, access to land, that is the bread and butter of estate agents. We're talking to provincial departments. I mean, we're talking to provincial governments. We're talking to Gauteng. We're talking to KZN. We're talking to the Free State, Northern Cape, Limpopo. They've all come to the party and they're willing to participate to give stock to our estate agents in those particular areas so that we can stimulate the growth and then we can not only stimulate growth, but we also stimulate the interest within this particular sector. Even the internship program has also increased in terms of the numbers of people that we're looking for. With regard to transformation, I think I've already spoken to the issue around the illegal estate agents that you spoke to, the issue around incubation. I also stated that with the incubation, we're not only looking to increase the number of principals because we believe that estate agents, especially HDI estate agents, should not look forward to just being employed by another estate agent, but they must also be principals so that they can run their own businesses. And we think by doing that, that will not only increase retention, but we also think it will increase growth and interest within the sector. And they will also be in turn be able to take on interns within their businesses. And also, you raised the issue around the incubation for old estate agents being sustained within the sector. Remember, that is you are raising a very critical point, and I think that is something that has been debated at great length within the EAB as to whether we look at empowering new SMMEs who come with new, fresh, innovative ideas, or do we empower the ones who have been in the sector and help them to grow? And I think the board then resolved that we need to have a two-pronged strategy where we empower SMMEs who are, in most cases, your young and new players in the sector, but simultaneously also empower those who have been in the system and reward them for having been in the system legally and help them to grow, because a lot of them find it difficult to grow from one level to another, from an SMME into a bigger enterprise. So that is why the board has then also said we are committing not only in terms of policy, but in terms of funding. There is an amount that has been set aside, which will be both a grant and a loan in order to propel these particular enterprises going forward. Then the first question was then asked by Honorable Mohlala. Honorable Member, I think I have spoken to the issue of transformation. Yes, it is a very difficult hill to climb, but we believe that we're up for the task and we will do everything in our power to make sure that we do transform. And the issue around the targets, yes, there are specific targets in terms of the APP that we have presented. We have indicated that with regard to interns, we would expect that we'll bring in as many as between 2,000 and 5,000 interns per year. And we do believe that will actually create a serious dent in relation to the numbers of estate agents. So we expect in the third year, we'll start to really see the effect of that. But over and above that, in terms of the SME and incubation program, we're also saying every year we expect to at least set up 25 new companies. And when we talk companies, we're not talking one estate agent. We're talking an estate agent or a group of estate agents. And we are not even saying that we would expect them to only operate in one province. We'd expect for them to have as wide a footprint as possible. But we also expect them to have the right demographics from a gender and a disability point of view. And then we also expect that these specific entities will be the catalyst for future employment for Black interns within those establishments. And we think that will go a long way towards ensuring that there's transformation. And over and above that, the PDI resolution will also make sure that there is a renewed interest in relation to the sector by those who may have fallen off because of financial constraints. So we believe that those three strategies combined will actually yield better figures. And we expect that we will not only see a doubling of the figures of Black estate agents in the market. In fact, we expect that we will see an increase by tenfold. And then obviously in years to come, we expect that we will be on an up and up trajectory in this. I just want to indicate that, Chair, we would be reporting a lot, figures that are looking a lot better had it not been for the lockdown, because we then lost close to 6 months of economic activity. And I think that you all know that the estate agency sector involves a lot of contact because it relates to viewing of houses. It relates to moving in and out of leased premises. So we were quite hard hit by the lockdown, but we do believe that a lot of analysts have now seen an upward turn and a renewed interest in investment in the property sector. So we are hoping that the renewed investment will actually reap, will yield results. And at the end of this financial year, yes, we may not look as rosy as we would want to, but we believe that in 2021 and 2022 financial year, we will definitely see an upward turn. And the Property Practitioner Act will also help go a long way towards alleviating and dealing with the challenges in the sector from a transformation point of view. Thank you, Chairperson.
Deputy Chair.
The Deputy Chair would like to add on the CFO issue and the CFO on the issue around the assets, the devaluation of the assets. Thank you.
Maybe the CFO can add and then I'll come in at the end, CEO.
Thank you, Deputy Chair.
All right. Thank you very much, Chairperson and honourable members. Just on the issue of the devaluation of the Liberty investment, as at the end of February, the investment value of the Liberty investment was 169 million. On the 31st of March, we then received our investment statement for the month, and this showed a significant devaluation to 135 million. We then immediately on the 2nd of April, we engaged with Liberty seeking reasons why there was a significant 33 million devaluation in just 1 month. And the email that the response that we received from Liberty was that the COVID-19 pandemic actually ruptured the global markets, and this was really the main reason for this devaluation. I think we then engaged further with Liberty for two reasons. Firstly, we didn't feel that in 1 month there could be such a significant decrease in our portfolio. Secondly, our portfolio also has a guaranteed portion. And because of this, we felt that Liberty devalued our investment incorrectly. We then took the matter up with our Finance and Investment Committee as well as the board. The board and our Finance Committee then felt that we should engage our current service provider who deals with all our investments to engage with Liberty and to do a deep dive on the portfolio. They then also gave us the legal opinion that Liberty actually had no basis for devaluing the way that they did, simply because of the guaranteed. We then wrote to Liberty in August once this legal opinion came back. We then challenged Liberty and asked them to please reverse the devaluation. Liberty responded, but in their response, they just merely acknowledged our letter. It didn't really acknowledge the fact that there is a guaranteed portion, and then just really went back to the whole issue of the COVID-19. So I think, in effect, Liberty really seemed to have changed the spirit of the EAB's letter from a letter of demand to a mere complaint. I think this, for us, we just really viewed this as a diversion strategy by Liberty to downplay the essence of the letter, because we were quite clear from the analysis of our investment and the legal opinion that Liberty had no basis to adjust the policy benefits, hence our demand to reverse the adjustment. We then went back to FinCo and to the board, and it was agreed that we should appoint a legal company to litigate against Liberty. So we are just in the process of sourcing the three quotations so that we don't fall foul of any procurement. And as soon as we have sourced the successful legal company, we will then take action against Liberty, because we feel that Liberty honestly has no basis for this adjustment. Thank you very much, members. And I think the one request was that we keep the committee appraised, and we definitely will keep the committee appraised of future engagements with Liberty as well as the legal process. Thank you, members.
Deputy Chair.
Thank you, Chair. I think just thank you again for all the questions by the honourable members. Chairperson, I think CEO, the CFO, and the team have answered you know, most of the questions in quite a bit of detail, and also in the interest of time, I'm not going to repeat anything. I think the only issue I want to address is the issue around the request by the minister for the secondment for the CFO position. So that was a request to the chairperson and of the EAB board, and that request is been processed. So that matter is in hand. And then I think partly related is just the issue around the Property Practitioners Act. So the context really, I think, for these matters is the board, the current board, as we are, our term is actually coming to an end, and so we're a bit in a transitionary process. I think the committee will be aware that the advertisements have gone out for nomination for the new board. So this will be the board of now the new entity, the Property Practitioners Regulatory Entity. So partly, Chair, our task as this board, we were really, you know, also meant to kind of also just be in place until the Property Practitioners Regulatory Entity comes into being. So that's really the context around these issues, and I think also in terms of, you know, any critical appointments like CFO, etc., is just to ensure that there's a proper transition, and this happens as we move into the new entity. So, Chairperson, yeah, I mean, as we speak, I think the current board with we currently, I think, on extra time now. If we were playing a football match, and we're hoping, you know, that so probably the next time the board interacts with the committee, it will also probably be a new board. So I think from that perspective, if we are not interacting again with the committee, we just like to show our appreciation and thank the committee for all the engagement, and hopefully we have also fulfilled some of our tasks of overseeing some of the critical processes at the EAAP. Thank you very much, Chair.
Thank you very much, NHBRC.
Thank you, Chair. The question, the first question comes from Mamunensi Siswai, which is about the issue of ethical conduct. Yes, there are unethical conducts that we catch people. They actually range from internal staff colluding, home builders not enrolling, ensuring that their houses are enrolled, etc. We deal with them. We interdict them. And some we then take full disciplinary hearings. That is what I was talking about in this when I was saying there are these unethical conducts that some of the players in the market are playing. And sometimes they also collude with the homeowners. And then when there is a problem between the two of them, the parties, They come to NHBRC. Sometimes there has been a lot of damage that has already taken place in that case. Recently, last year and the year before, there was a practice in some of the provinces where there were people who were chasing provincial officials and the inspectors of NHBRC. In fact, some of them were kidnapped, and we had to get police and security guards to actually act against them, because they don't want their houses to be inspected. And when there are problems, there are problems with the houses that they are building, then they refuse to cooperate. There is a question that CFO can deal with when he commented about AG has identified some small gaps, and I'm not sure the amount of money that was lost, not found, if he knows about it. CFO?
Thank you, CEO. I think that the question it relates to the irregular expenditure, that 711 million that is on our annual report. So that relates to all the contracts starting from 2011 up to the year that just got audited, for cases that we appointed service providers without following correct SCM processes. That then resulted in those transactions being declared as irregular. So to deal with that, we have investigated those cases and taken appropriate corrective measures and made an application to National Treasury for condonation. Then there was a question around the gaps that were identified by the AG. In our SCM policy, we do make reference to the bid committees. However, some of the functions of those bid committees were actually captured onto the operating procedure. The AG was of the view that all of the functions that relate to bid committees should be captured on the SCM policy rather than them being captured on the SCM procedure. So we are in the process now of correcting that in our SCM procedure so that then it is aligned to the National Treasury regulations. Thank you, Chair.
And then there was also a comment about NHBRC having a duty to protect consumers. Yes, ma'am, I agree. Those are the challenges that we have to deal with. Now, within the context of the environment that I have indicated, part of the inability to protect our consumers is a legislation that is not in line with the industry in which we operate, and therefore you find we have to deal with the two parties first, and if one party delays, then the consumer is suffering throughout that process. And I think that is something we need to sort out, because a quasi insurance company warranty scheme needs to provide for agility to first take into account the interests of the consumer that has been done badly by a home builder. And I think they are inbuilt processes in the bill that are seeking to deal with that. Chairperson, you want to add?
Yes, thank you very much, CEO and CFO. Many thanks. Chairperson, I think the questions were largely answered, but may I just add on the issue of the houses that are closed by the state? Can I just say that yes, in terms of the new operations model and the inspection model, we are looking at greater oversight. And what we certainly are looking forward to, Chair, and I believe what is going to be an important component of the exercise is greater liaison between the department, the provincial departments, and the NHBRC, where there will be follow-ups and projects that are approved for implementation and construction. This will ensure that the NHBRC is aware of which projects have been approved and which would have been enrolled, so that the NHBRC can keep track and ensure that those projects are inspected. Chair, may I, on behalf of our team, say thank you very much for having us, and we look forward to any other questions that you might have, and we'll be very happy to answer them. And thank you for this evening. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much, Chair of the NHBRC. Honourable Member, any follow-up questions?
Chair, it's Honourable Powell. I would just like to request that the CEO of the EAAB has said she can furnish us with the information furnished to the AG. I'm surprised that the Parliamentary Portfolio Committee would be presented with AG findings that the CEO was not aware of. So the CEO says she believes it had been remedied, but the Portfolio Committee was presented with those findings. So perhaps we can remedy this confusion if the CEO's office could provide this committee with all the information given to the AG in relation to the alleged procurement irregularities. So we'll await on your office for that, Chairperson. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Power. Honorable Zeki.
Sorry. Just on two items, Chair. I think on our behalf, you will thank the board of the EAB. And the issue that I raising my hand for, Chair, is what the NHRB is saying in relation to what I would call corruption and tendencies that are wrong, where even their staff was attacked. I think probably let's not stop it there. Maybe even beyond this, Chair, you can be briefed, and maybe on behalf of the committee, you raise a public statement and showing support to NHBRC, and also I think requesting the police to do their intensive work to can deal with the culprit. Thank you very much, Chair. And I think it's quite unfortunate for such incidents to take place.
Thank you.
Honorable Jack, I've missed part, you know, the network is, can you repeat the last statement?
Okay, I was saying maybe on behalf of the committee, for you to make a statement in support of the NHBRC and also requesting the police to act swiftly to can get into to get the culprits to be taken through the legal process, and for us to support. I mean, they can brief you, Chair, because maybe now there may not be time where they can brief you on those areas. I think I've been raising this matter, Chair. We got a number of complaints through the in our townships or in the towns where we stay around illegal builders. I would call them illegal builders. I was also indicating this to EAAB, that these are some of the things that we need to look at. People who are just erecting structures anyway, anyhow, before the consent of the state. And now this one, of taking the employees while doing their legitimate work. It's quite unfortunate. Thank you.
Okay, no, thank you, Honorable Zeki. Let me take this opportunity to thank, allow the department if there is anything that they want to raise, DG Shangane and DM Chwete, before we close.
Afternoon, Chair. Chair, just to indicate, DG Shangane asked to be excused because he's got a flight to Cape Town. It's directly related to the EAAB. On the point, Chair, that was raised around the question of the appointment of the Property Practitioners Regulatory Board, in fact, the DG together with the Ministry are shortlisting tomorrow for a set of names to be provided to Minister for consideration in relation to the Property Practitioners Regulatory Authority. So thanks, Chair. I thought I'd just raise that point and note the point of DG Shangane's having excused himself about half an hour ago. Thank you.
Thank you very much, DDG, Acting DG. DM Chwete.
Thank you very much, Chair. I must say it has been a long day from 9:30, Chair, and I have another meeting after this one. But Chair, let me make a general comment, and let me start by saying we will monitor 5 priorities that were highlighted by CSOs. The CSOs highlighted 5 areas, and they said they're going to fast track those, and we will definitely monitor those areas, whether they are being implemented or not. And I do want to say, Chair, you know, in all the entities that are here, let's make sure that we fill all the senior positions. We have unemployment, which is high because of COVID-19. And Muhammad Dubi Moshala, you spoke about the interns, the high number of interns that you intend to take. And I request that you also consider the rural areas when you take those interns. And I see, Chair, there is a lot of work that has been done by our entities. Of course, there are areas that need to be monitored by the department, and I promise that we will do that definitely. We will show a different picture in the next financial year. We will make sure that we fill the gaps that you have raised. And I want also to thank the 3 entities. Chair, I know that you are going to thank them, but on behalf of the department, and want to thank them for the work that they're doing. I know they've been a COVID-19, which made some of our entities and also our work not to do the work because of COVID-19. There were delays there and there, but we hope that in the next financial year, we are going to show a different picture, Chair. Chair, the last thing that I would like to raise, Chair, is that the all entities presented to the committee, and if there are any areas that need follow up, and please make sure that you do that. And also, I want to support Honorable Peggy, what you've made or commented on the statement that must be done by the chairperson, and we support that, Chair, fully, that there should be a statement made by the chairperson, and you will get our support, because that's an abuse. We fight the gender-based abuse, Chair. The staff which was threatened, and we need to open up cases along those lines. And I do want to thank you, Chair, and also the portfolio committee. I know you are all tired from 9:30, and the time now is close to 6:30. All these hours you've been sitting, and thank you very much for the good work that you are doing. And thank you very much, Chair. Thank everyone. Thank you.
Thank you very much, GM, and your team. Let me take this opportunity to thank in particular the board of EAAB because their term of office has come to an end. We want to, on behalf of the portfolio committee, congratulate them for the good work that they have done, because we have not actually have difficulty with the board since their inception, and we hope they will be available for other future prospects in the system, but on the public service to serve our people. And want to thank you, Deputy Chairperson, and send our regards to the chair. And we want to thank you very much. And as a committee, we like to thank you dearly for when we call, you've been availing yourselves without complaints. And thank you very much. But again, thanking the other entities that are here, the chair of CISOS, the chair of NHBRC for your availing yourselves. As a portfolio committee, we'll continue to welcome our engagement with yourselves as we intensify the struggle to change the life of our people, because as entities, you have much responsibility to make sure that your responsibility as assigned by the department through the minister, it's been your assignment is linked to the priorities of the department. Therefore, your contribution towards attaining the MTFS is very critical. And just to emphasize on what Honorable Powell has said on besides sending the documents to us, I think it will be important, CEO of EAAB, there is a need for us to interact and deal with these issues that was raised by Auditor General, because you should understand our role as Portfolio Committee is that the Auditor General is appointed by us to do oversight on our behalf, particularly because of the required skills that is needed into the audit. And any issues or any matters that have been raised which affect their integrity or the work that they do, it's a responsibility of Portfolio Committee to make sure that we clear the air, so that there should be a better working relationship with yourself, and we should then avail yourself for further engagement with ourselves and with my office in particular, so that we are able to engage the Auditor General without wanted to raise the issues the issues or questioning the outcome of the audit, because if we reach that level, we are going to have a problem. So we know how you feel about particularly when you have worked very hard to attain the unqualified, but there is these issues that are standing block. But we just want to raise that who would want an environment where the audit as an outcome, the final audit binds all of us, whether you're not happy or you are, your feelings are otherwise. As a portfolio committee, we take that, but we can still engage and on that matter just to make it better, to make it to make sure that the outcome in the next financial year becomes, there is that a proper engagement and without the doubts that come out after the audit. So Auditor General represents us as Parliament. So I think it should be understood on that note. And the issue that Honorable Powell has read something on the CHAD group, just to say that the offices in Western Cape is last week. There are people, they are not answering their phone. Please, CEO, check those, what might be the challenge, and so that, because we believe in Batupele, your services, is needed by your customers. Therefore, they must feel home when they engage with your offices. It might be there, but there might be technical error somewhere, but it's important that you take this matter up with the office in Western Cape and see what might be the problem. And you can communicate with Honorable Powell only after you found out what might be the issues. And I want to take this opportunity to thank members. Indeed, there's not been an easy one during this part of BRRR. It's not an easy day because of we have to engage in long hours. And thank you very much, members, for the participation. And thanks the board, and particularly the chairs of the board and the CEOs and the department, which is playing oversight on the entities, and the GM for availing yourself for this meeting. And thank you very much. The meeting stands adjourned. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Chairperson. Well, there's a question. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair and members. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you, members. Bye.
Is that Leon? Is Leon here? Oh,
hello.
Hello. Hi. Good evening. Mampana, good evening.
Good. Are we not having another meeting now? Hey, Mastroy.
Hello? Is there any COVID?
I thought there was another meeting now at 6.
Hey, Animal. The meeting is attended. You don't go.
I'm having my entities as an Indian. As a home, sir.
Well, let's see me.
Oh, well, let's see me.
Yes.
Got in the afternoon.
Kabanika is Sandom. Kabanika is.
Go 6.
Okay.
You want to say that I'm fine with him? Let's see. Go 6.
And if I'm banished and I lay, okay. Well, you have Kumbula, you call me to 6.
Hello.
Bye-bye.
Hello. Hey.